Okay, so Brianna, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, everyone. Hello, sorry about the confusion. My name is Brianna, and I'm a trans woman addicted to a drug called alcohol. I introduce myself thusly because, in my opinion, alcohol is the most ancient, deadliest, and insidious drug on the planet. And I consider it the gateway drug in our society, and even a lot of AA rooms are in denial of this fact, which costs countless of lives and suffering. So I say this to keep it in the forefront of my conscience. Much like when I take the first step every morning. I'm grateful that I hadn't had a drink today. And I'm grateful that you're all here holding a meeting I can attend. As some of you may or may not know, I have to take the first step every morning when I awaken. My drunken log is like most of yours in this meeting. I drank my way out of two universities. I talked my way out of two DUIs before I got stuck with my first one. And even then, I talked my way into a diversion. I wrecked careers. I banged up cars. I passed out in the front yard numerous times. I wrecked a credit. I suffered days and nights and years of continuous hangovers. And, I spent countless hours conniving, scheming, and trying to figure out how to get my daily alcohol fix and keep the supply flowing. I was born and raised as a child of school teachers in Hutchinson, Kansas, which is located like on the northern tip of the Southern Plains. Okay. Both my parents came off the farm. My maternal grandparents lived in a town called Ulysses, Kansas. It's on a short grass prairie on the high plains. And my paternal grandparents lived on the family farm north of Cowtown, Ellsworth, Kansas. So I was the first generation that was born off the farm. But we spent most of our time on the farm because in those days, you went back and helped with harvest and stuff like that. So I kind of consider my upbringing a mixture of both half rural and half suburban. I'm the eldest of four children, two of us of which are alcoholic. Now, my other two siblings are, those strange people that can and do imbibe in alcohol normally. I'm the only sibling currently in recovery that I know of. I really feel for my brother, and I do hope he finds a path, but that's not up to me. And that was one of the hard lessons I had to accept in this that, I cannot bring a family member into these halls. They have to find their way themselves. A family member, I think, is more apt to push a member out, potential member out. And I don't like the word member, but that's what I kind of the way I kind of look at it. Someone an alcoholic in dire need of help, and you just want to grab that loved one and bring him in, and probably not the thing to do for either of you in the long run. So I'd always talk to a sponsor about that before I made such a move. I'm of Irish and Bohemian descent on my father's side, and of Scottish and German descent on the maternal side of the gene pool. Both my grandfathers and all four great grandfathers are known alcoholics, not to mention a maternal uncle, aunts and great aunts, and many great uncles from my paternal branch. Being a cowgirl, I still am convinced that genetics play a large part of my disease. My mother and her father, my grandfather, tried to warn me as to the dangers of alcoholism in our family on several occasions. But teenagers aren't too smart, and they don't listen. And when they want to be cool in front of their peers, all that knowledge is flying out their ears, as a bottle comes up to their lips. However, I want to make it perfectly clear that my ancestors did not hold my head beneath the taps nor pour any rum down my throat. I cheerfully did that myself every time I went to get drunk. The child-rearing wisdom of the 1970s was this, and it was taught in drug education almost. It was almost taught this way. As long as the kids are drinking, they're not really doing drugs, And this perception is still espoused today, particularly in rural settings and often even in rooms of recovery. That sociological norm is also played into my disease. And the truth is this, that alcohol is a drug, and the only drug that has no antidote for an immediate antidote for an overdose. And that's how they, and it's insidious. It takes years to fester, and it ruins countless lives along the way, not only the alcoholic, the addicts. I first experienced gender dysphoria in March of my 14th year. Long story short is I'd found a porn magazine. I bought a porn magazine, and this is where I saw my first transgender woman, and it struck me to the core. And I knew that that's what I was, that I was that woman. And, the shame was just overwhelming. So, did I drink at my dysphoria? That's still kind of a question in my mind. And it's one I don't really wrestle with it, to be quite honest. I consider myself, an alcoholic first, I suppose. And, of all things. And I think that's kind of helped me hold on to that first step. So, did I drink towards that? I don't know. And I don't worry about that today because I know that if I just take that first step, I don't have to worry about it. So, anyway, enough on that. I had my first beer on my 15th birthday in April of that year, and I distinctly remember how impressed my peers were with the volume of alcohol I could consume. All of a sudden, I was cool and I can fit in. Now, before I had my first beer, I had a paper route, and it was in a part of town where on the main drag. In those days, people got in their cars and they drove up and down, in small rural towns. And you had to have the cool car and the fastest car, blah, blah, blah. And but anyway, one of the turnaround points was on my paper route. And so every Saturday morning and every Sunday morning, when the morning papers came out, the kids and me got scared of leaving beer in their car or alcohol in their car, or they would stash it in this little turnaround. There was this little triangular park, and they would stash it there. And I was up, 5 in the morning, 4 in the morning. So I'd find these and I'd stash them in an old doghouse, and I would sell them. So I was bootlegging before I was drinking. So, that's how insidious this disease is. That's just half the way I got to be cool, It was pretty profitable too, anyway, when I started drinking alcohol, I understood that alcohol temporarily quelled any fire storms in my head concerning my life and my growing gender dysphoria. And I realized that my peers considered to be my hard drinking was a desirable alpha male trait. And I kind of adopted that as a huge part of my man shield that I used to survive. And by the time I was 16, I drank to get drunk every time I raised a bottle or a can, and I could easily outdrink my peers. It's also easy to recount my lengths of sobriety between my adolescence and recovery. I had two. One lasted 3 months when I was training for Kansas State football in 1979 and 1980. And the others for about 6 weeks in 1984, after I drank myself out of the University of Kansas. I was studying English. Well, I was supposed to be studying English, but I was drinking. In fact, in my second attempt at sobriety, I was back living with my parents, and I was paying rent, and I was staying sober, and I had a little job, and we had this family reunion, a 4th of July family reunion. And my own mother came up to me, and I was acting as a bartender, and I was, cooking the meat. I was playing chef and doing the hostess things. And my mother looks at me, and I guess I'd hand someone a diaper or something. She goes, "Well, I think you could just have one." And, I caught a resentment over that because I got drunk for 10 more years. It was just like that. I never did. I heard someone share the other day, and it was a great share for a gentleman that had decades of sobriety, like 50. And he said, "I never drank. I never said to go, let's go get a drink. I always said, let's go get drunk." And that was my attitude towards alcohol, even then. Even when I was 16, that was kind of my altitude. So I had caught this resentment against my mother, and then I realized it wasn't my mother who pulled that alcohol down my throat. It was me that did that. But I also want to say that's why you don't, there again, family members that aren't alcoholics really don't understand you. And it takes a while sometimes to build those bridges. So, patience is a virtue, I suppose. I now understand she was just trying to be kind. And I think intuitively she knew I needed alcohol to fit in. And getting rid of that resentment was very big for me. And for me, alcoholism, I think, is very wave-like. I'm either riding on very high or I'm down in the pits in the bottom of the low. And that can happen in a matter of hours sometimes or days, I found as when I was drinking, I found I was either riding high or I was down in the bottoms. I met my wife, the Queen of the Al-Anons, in 1987. We got married in 1987. We met in 86. And we got married on the family farm, actually, in August of 87. And we had two children. And one of them, who is one of us, who now has 5 years. And I'm so happy to be able to say that because it fills my heart with joy that with the trials and tribulations she had. Especially having being a child of an alcoholic, I'm glad she survived, and I'm glad she's doing well. So, but anyway, during the final months of my drinking career, by the time of my 7th year of marriage, and in the final months of that drinking career, my wife made me come home by 7 p.m. every Wednesday night with $1 so she could attend Al-Anon meetings. And I also resented that dollar for a long time. And the drink it represented, because that came out of whatever scam or whatever, however I'd obtain any money to get drunk that day, But I did it because I wanted to keep the marriage together, and it turned out to be a pretty good investment of my time and money. But after 7 years of this drinking up and down and all these things I did, she farmed out the cubs one night and told me it was time for divorce. And to be quite honest, I wasn't too surprised. I was kind of half planning for it. And I was pretending to be a self-employed carpenter at the time. But as she was talking, I stood at the window and I looked outside, and I had kind of had an epiphany. I could see myself pushing a shopping cart, one of those steel shopping carts full of tools on the streets, from bar to bar for drinks and tips. And I saw someone else raising my kids, and I thought about my wife, finding someone else to love. And so I said, hey, I'll do anything. I'll even go to AA. And she said, well, I think you need AA, but that's not going to stop the divorce plant. You're still getting divorced even if you go to AA. Now, at that time, I'd already known that AA really worked. I had an uncle who had 10 years. And he was one of those people that kind of kept me out of the rooms, maybe. And I carried resentment about that for a little bit. And then he and I talked it over. But it's just something I kind of I would like to caution, the people, it's in early sobriety or, between the 3 to 10 year decade type. Because you want to save everyone. You really want to love and help them, and you can see that they're struggling. You can see the disease has the grip on them. But one of the premiers of this idea of IA is only you can call yourself an alcoholic, and you have to keep that at the forefront of your mind, I think. And by doing that, you're an example, and it's attraction instead of promotion. So anyway, I knew AA worked. And so I crawled into the rooms of AA and I said this simple word, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And then I don't remember a lot, except it was a first step meeting, obviously, because, in those days of tradition at Monroe House will stop everything and do a first step meeting. And that is so important to any group. Your newcomer always, should come before any other topic, any other subject. anything else that's going on in the room. That newcomer comes first because they're closest to the flame. So, when I came into the rooms, I was bereft of hope. What I heard that night gave me hope. And I took that hope. And Mono House AA became my first home group. And they told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I did 90 meetings at about 30. Because quite honestly, I was scared to come off the porch, And so I would just stay until they had another meeting, another meeting, and another meeting. And then when we moved up to the farm, the group in Salina, New Beginnings, became my home group. They had a lot of meetings. They solved a lot of problems for us by having it in Salina because I could attend multiple meetings. I could, and it would fit any schedule I had, when I was up there. So, and it was a very good group. If you're in the Salina area, look them up. It's a good face-to-face meeting. I was already an atheist and agnostic when I entered AA, and I never have, nor have I ever, joined in with the Christian prayers in any AA group or meeting I really attended. A couple of weeks I came as concerned. I stood up and held hands and kind of looked around and done those things. And, I'm not going to say I haven't been ornery and made faces at the kids and, done anything like that. That might have happened. But I never did do any praying. And then a couple of weeks into the program, I became concerned as an atheist that, I wasn't going to be accepted or I wouldn't get it. And a man who became my sponsor explained it the second step to me. Is he said, pretty much, don't you believe that 16 ounce of beer or that 1 ounce shot of rum kicked your ass every time you touched it? And that's just one power of grading yourself right there. And he told me to take it easy and take that first step daily. And the rest of the steps would follow in their own time and space. Bob B also had a lot of good sayings I still use to this day. Probably one of the best ones. If you don't take that first drink, you don't get drunk. And, take that first step every morning before you get out of bed. It just makes your day easier. And I did those things, and after I got my first year, he gave me the brass coin, and he says, "Well, okay, here you go. Put this coin in your mouth before you take this first drink, and then when it dissolves, call me. We'll both get drunk together, and I'll buy that first bottle of rum." And so that never happened. And Bob died sober after a long period of sobriety. He had 9 years in front of me. And he was one of my AA heroes. Get AA heroes as you go on through this this program. I read the big book in a 20-hour setting, and I consider there's a lot of information, and there are a lot of kernels of knowledge in that big book. And I think the AA preamble is a milestone in literature and philosophy, and I compare it to the Magna Carta or the Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And most AA halls have posters and platitudes on the walls. And Monroe has had one I used to see quite a lot, but I haven't seen it in quite a while because I haven't been to face-to-face meeting in quite a while, or traditionally. But it used to say G dot O dot D dot God. And about my third week in the program, I asked a member of the group how that organization is not allied with any sect, denomination, organization, or religion could justify having God upon its walls. And they explained that God stood for good order direction. And I kind of used that idea of good order direction as my idea of a power greater than myself when someone would go into a trance and start talking about God and, biblically things, shall we say. So that was it. So you have to listen. And one of the best things I fell into this habit of listening is that about 30 days into my sobriety, my cranky old sponsor made me start leading meetings, chairing meetings, And so service work is a huge part of my sobriety and serenity. And I didn't realize it, until the pandemic when I was honored to assume the position I hold now for the Kansas City We Agnostic Group. And I had a really great sponsor Betty E was my first female sponsor. We never talked about my gender dysphoria. She kind of called me her artistic sponsor. She's the one that taught me how to do the fourth step and when to do it. And she walked me through my first fourth step. And she taught me the trick of doing the 10th step as I walk through life. And by doing that, by taking that 10th step as I walk through life, I found I don't have to take as many fourth steps. You know, if I'm cognizant of what's going on around me, my place in any conflict, then I don't have to make as many amends, you know, if I'm trying to put myself in the other person's shoes. So her lessons were invaluable. She also had taught me how to drink really strong coffee. And, you know, I really miss her. My sponsor in Salina, Kansas, always talked about his alcoholism as being very selfish. And every time he spoke, it's kind of like every time I speak, I always ramble back to the first step. Imagine that. And Ron would always talk about the selfishness of the disease and how it wasn't just the alcoholism, but his own selfishness that he was working on within himself. You know, as that inner child that he was always trying to please. And always talked about putting your selfish wants like drinking aside and doing the right thing for those and those around you. And I found that to be quite a refreshing viewpoint. I came to the agnostic rooms in Kansas City. We have face-to-face meetings 5 days a week. And if I'll put those in the into the chat. Well, I'm sure if one of our members is here, they can do that too. But the Kansas City agnostics and free thinkers groups are my new cherished home group. I discovered my 24th AA birthday, actually. It was the first AA birthday after the Queen of the Alamance died in my arms of stomach cancer on the farm. And I was in a lot of pain and I needed a meeting. And, you know, the door was open. And when I walked into that, when I walked in that meeting, I discovered what I knew an AA meeting could be. You know, there wasn't a lot of reading of script, like, you know, there wasn't a lot of readings and sayings and stuff like that. Someone presented a topic, they went around the room, they didn't even talk about the money. They just, a gentleman literally took a ball cap off of his head, and people threw money in the hat. He counted the money, put it in his pocket, put the hat back on his head. And it was a one. And when they closed the meeting with our meeting is now concluded. And it was just like wonderful. And, you know, there were people of all pigmentations were represented. That was the first time I'd ever seen one of my own. It's the first time I'd ever seen a trans woman. And, you know, and she has several years ahead of me also too. You know, she's one of my heroes, though we don't communicate very much. So, and I just fell in love with this group, and they're everything to me. And actually, I came out to the group in the winter solstice of 2019. We had a holiday gala, and my sponsor Jenny hosted the gala, and well, I had responded to her from from Brianna's email, and so she asked me my name, and no one had asked me my name because I had introduced myself in another manner. And so I told her, and I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said yes, she would, with the proviso that we could sponsor each other. And I'm so lucky to have it. I know some people don't think that sponsorship is necessary, and bravo to them. You know, good. I'm glad. But I found having sponsors, like, when it really gets hard, they're the people you need to ask. You know, and your guidance has been great for me. It's, you know, I've moved through this, and I changed gender. So anyway, she told me I should come out to the group, and I came out to the group, and that's and for the first time in my life, I said, "Hi everyone, my name's Brianna, and I'm an alcoholic." And the wave of love that emotional love that washed over to me, I've never felt since. And it was a great thing. And so if you're, I guess the moral of that story is if your sponsor tells you to do something, you should do it. I think the COVID and Zoom rooms have forever changed, AA, both in religious and secular meetings. And as I punch meeting codes into my keyboard every day, I can't help but hearing the phrase going to any length in my head and remembering that there were a couple of times I walked a couple of miles to get to the meeting because I goddamn needed it, you know. And now all I have to do is get on my keyboards or my little telephone, and I can be in a meeting around the world. And so, getting to meetings, you know, meeting makers make it. I kind of believe that now. I see that. I attend four inclusive AA groups on in the Zoomiverse on a regular basis. And I'm astounded and inspired by all the people living entering these rooms in the Zoom in the Zoom rooms, and they're how they're getting sober and how they carry on. I mean, it's just wonderful to see the changes, you know, as they get that 90 days and you know they get that first pink cloud, and you know, it makes me want to come back. And so service work's important, I think. I also almost cry every time an old timer enters a secular meeting that they have, you know, the first time they've ever, and it still happens. I'm kind of astounded it still happens now, you know, so far out of the pandemic and the in advance of Zoom. But every once in a while, you get that old, you know, 30, 40-year-old person, year-old AA person that rolls in and says, "I didn't know these existed." And you just, those are the days you just kind of have to ignore any rules about, you know, time limit share. You just kind of say, oh, let them go. They need to unload. Because, you know, I remember that. That's the way I felt the day I walked into my first Kansas City meeting. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, we were speaking of pandemics, that alcohol is a real pandemic and it grips humanity. It's a tool used to keep societies in check. It's a tool used for people to accept substandard living conditions and lies and laws. And so we need to keep that in the front of our minds as this sobering up begins as we move forward, you know, because I do think that the secular AA rooms and the Zoom rooms will become a major inspiration to those as society and our civilization moves forward. I think it's also best to remember the correct definition of what it takes to have an AA meeting, and that's only two drunks in a coffee pot. In its infancy, AA did not have a big book, nor did we have any sponsors. In decades of societies, we had people doing speaker meetings like this, you know, sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other. And in closing, I'd like to qu quote what my friend Fernando G. of Mineral House often said many times, and newcomers show up for their first AA meeting ever. He would say, "There's no shame in being alcoholic. The shame is when you realize you're alcoholic and do nothing about it." And he also said, "Religion is for those that fear hell, and spirituality is for those who have been there." And they really helped me get through this first 24 years until I found secular AA. And in secular AA, what I've noticed, one of the first thing I noticed in my first year was that in How It Works, the first 235 words, they talk about rigorous honesty, you know, three times. And being honest with myself, coming out as Brianna, being free of the idea that I had to accept someone else's version to get sober is such a concept. And I thank you all for that. And I thank you for your time.